Morton once told me I could never be like him. Now I understand why. Wouldn't have bothered him knowing you were around somewhere alive.
So you found out you're not a businessman after all?
Just a man.
An ancient race. Other mortals will be along, and they'll kill it off.
Future don't matter to us. Nothing matters now, not the land, not the money, not the woman. I came here to see you. Because I know that now you'll tell me what you're after.
Welcome to the Three Film Egos. I'm your hirsute host, Isaac Jensen, and with me as always is Utah's whitest black child, Clayton Godby.
Cook up the pasta, put the pasta sauce on it. That I do probably like three nights a week.
And our resident vegan dreadlocked Portlandier, Ryan Cragen.
I don't like pasta very much anymore. I lost my mind eating too much pasta.
This is a film discussion podcast where we each pick a film based on a predetermined theme or topic and then talk about anything but. There will be tangents. There will not be spoiler alerts. Consider yourselves warned. On this episode, Revenge.
All right, Micmacs. It's a 2009 film from Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who's a pretty well-known French director. I kind of like to refer to him as the French Terry Gilliam, just because of his emphasis on visuals and his like imagination in that regard. This one's about it starts off with a scene of it's at war. I imagine it's kind of a World War II kind of thing, or I don't know exactly, but it shows a son getting news that his father was killed. And, the first scene is the father getting killed with that landmine. Like, he's a dude kind of dusting off landmines, trying to disarm it. And it goes off, kills him. The son gets news, and he is a curious kid, and he pulls out they got photos of the scene and the mine that goes off has a logo on it. And the son notices that logo. And then it cuts to, what was it, like 30 years later, he's working in a video store, video rental place, and just randomly one night, car chase, and a gun goes off, and the gets lodged in it just accidentally. And that kind of sets up the theme of coincidence. There's a lot of coincidence in this film. There's quite a bit of coincidence. And so when the bullet gets pulled out, or someone finds the shell casing and has a logo on it, and then randomly one day when he's making a delivery, or he's pulling stuff. He falls into this band of kind of outsiders, homeless people who live in a junkyard, and I guess they're called the Micmacs. I mean, that's the kind of logo that's above the door at the junkyard hideout. And he's going and collecting junk, and his car breaks down in the street, and on one side of the street is the business, the arms dealer, with the logo from the mine that killed his father, and on the other side of the street is the arms dealer that has the logo for the bullet that went into his head. And so the rest of the film is kind of him getting together with all these, you know, outsiders and plotting a revenge on these two corporations by pretty much kind of pitting the two against each other to try and destroy each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a fair summary.
That sounds about like the movie.
Yeah. And I picked this because it's one I'd wanted to see.
So
I'm a fan of the director, Jean-Pierre Jeunet. I've seen a lot of his other stuff, and I knew I was going to enjoy it thoroughly because I've enjoyed pretty much everything I've seen by him.
Yeah, in high school I was a huge fan of Amelie, as I think pretty much everybody was, and it's like an American person's French movie. Like, it's an easy way to kind of watch a French movie and get into a little bit of French culture. And so I've watched this director for a while, and I remember seeing this movie in theaters and feeling like it's pretty consistent with the rest of his work, like you said, with the visual style and everything, but that it's even more playful, maybe. It seems like with that synopsis, like it would be really serious subject matter and really intense, but it's still really funny and really playful throughout, mm-hmm. And I like that about this movie.
Yeah, it's essentially a comedy.
Yeah, I laughed a lot in this movie. It ridiculous things. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the funniest scenes was when a soccer player gets blown up by a landmine.
Yeah.
So that kind of gives you a little window into, you know, how playful he can make even a gnarly subject.
Yeah, and along that line, the tone stayed pretty consistent. It was very, yeah, like you said, lighthearted, playful, comedic, until it gets to the point where they're actually getting, like, the final ultimate revenge, where they have the two arms dealers, got them captured. They divide this whole plot to make them think they're going to Afghanistan, where pretty much all of their products are wreaking havoc on innocent people. And the scene has all of the Micmacs dressed up in what are they called? Totally spacing.
I don't know.
Like the headscarves, the full, like, on, you know, Islamic.
The hijab?
Yeah, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all dressed up in black hijabs, or, you know, whatever the Islamic garb is. Mostly women wear. And all you see is their eyes. And each one of them is holding a photo of, like, a dead person, a child or a relative. And it got super serious at that point. Like, almost to the point where it lightheartedness for a second, and made me kind of really reflect on what it's trying to say. Like, you know, even though this is, you know, business, it's corporation, that they're all innocent victims that people don't really want. And it made me think about it. And I appreciated that, but it felt totally.
Did it cut out for you, Clayton?
Yep, I'm not hearing Isaac.
Yeah.
I'm here. Shit, what's going on?
I don't know. It's your phone goes into this crazy netherworld sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, it's like one word that you say, this zones out for like 5 seconds, and then it comes back in. It's weird. And then it works for a while, then it screws up again. But it definitely fucks up like once every two sentences.
Really? That much?
Yeah, for me. I don't know what's going on.
No, I'm gonna disconnect and try and get back on.
All right. Do you want to swap phones? I guess that's what he can try.
I would expect my phone to do that because my phone is so cheap. I, like, purchased it at a Harmon's. And sometimes I don't even get reception. I don't even get reception in my own bedroom, which is, like, just barely in the basement of my house.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I don't.
So
I barely
I usually
get reception
expect
in my basement
to have
too.
Those same problems, but it muscles through pretty well.
I think, like, the only black hole around for my phone is right where we live, so that's nice. It's like, go anywhere besides inside my living room and the phone works fine.
Yeah, damn, that's annoying.
Damn convenient. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure we heard the same stuff, right? He'd be talking and go, wow. Sound like he's shooting
out
into space.
Yeah, it would sound like it was, like, fading out.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And then coming back in. All
right. All
right, I'm back.
All right, that sounds good.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, so where did we leave off? Talking about how serious it was, and then...
Yeah, do you think we should kind of scrap all that and start over because of the issues, or do you think it'll be fine?
I think some, like, just that last little chunk. I mean, it's up to you, really. We can start over, but maybe you can just merge the two. I know you don't want to spend time editing, but...
I think a good majority of what you had said was good and came through.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
well, I'll listen to it, and if, you know, if I have to, maybe I'll put up a little note at the beginning of the episode saying, we had some issues, sorry, it's kind of muddy, but you're not paying for it, so stop complaining.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Cool.
Yeah, so where were we?
It got super serious.
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though it's corporations, we don't like those, you know, basically screwing people over, and it gets serious. This movie is hard to take serious at all, though, you know, because it's just so playful, its tone and its imagery. You mentioned that he was Terry Gilliam. I think he is in some ways. I think he's definitely creative, but just not in the same way. I don't know. He kind of reminds me of just being a kid a little bit, and so he makes movies that remind me of being a kid.
Our main character is very childlike in his demeanor.
He even, like, kind of bickers with children a couple times, or I guess that one time toward the beginning. Where he has a snapping fight with a group of kids that have raided his belongings that were in a basement.
I liked watching this movie a lot. I thought it was ridiculous, but perfect.
And see, I see what Isaac's saying, though. Like, it's a different kind of revenge movie, because at the beginning, it starts out where you just think that he's getting revenge for things that happened to him, and the nature of the coincidence that was a part of the tragedies that happened to him made it seem sort of strange that he would be so adamant to get revenge. But then I think in that last really serious scene that Isaac was describing is where you kind of, for me, I started to understand why this character would do that. It's because in addition to the wrongs that have happened to him in his life and losing his job and losing everything he had and having to be homeless for a while, they're getting revenge for a whole group of people that have been wronged by corporations. And it's this, like, teaching a lesson and getting back someone who's done something to a large group of people, as opposed to a lot of revenge films being, like, very personal. Like, this happened to me, now you're going to get yours.
And it definitely emphasizes working with other people, too, quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a team of people.
Yeah, it's not a singular revenge movie, yeah.
There was one quirk I noticed as in regards to the visuals. I don't know if you guys noticed it as well, but in the background in several scenes, there were ads for the movie, Micmacs, that had a kind of variation of the scene you were actually seeing. Did you guys notice that?
No.
I didn't see any of that. Really?
I saw it like three times in the film. Like, it was mostly when they were traveling from one spot to another. I think like one of the first times our main character goes out in his truck, and he's going down a street. And on the building in the background, there's a billboard that shows that exact same shot, but from a slightly different angle. And it says, like, Micmacs coming to theater soon or something like that.
I don't know.
I watched it on Blu-ray, so it might have been, like, a Blu-ray update or something. I don't know. Or maybe I was able to see it better.
Wow. Maybe.
But, yeah, I mean, the reason...
More.
I don't know. I have found I've become a much more conscious film watcher in the last year or two. And I notice I'm able to kind of expand my focus. I mean, especially with foreign films, I've watched so many foreign films that I'm used to reading while actually seeing what's going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. Whereas most people, you know, complain about, you know, they spend so much time reading the text that they don't get to really delve into the imagery.
Which would be a shame in these films, because so much of it is the look of it. Like, it's a very interesting Paris that he kind of portrays here, where the colors are kind of like beiges and kind of washed out, but yet it's still really interesting. It's still something you want to look at. It's not depressing, really. It's just kind of bland until you see the action that's going on. But I guess I could have looked more even at what was going on the whole screen.
Yeah.
I wonder what the reasoning would be for advertising your own film in the film.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it was just one of those little like Easter egg things he threw in there, just to, like, you know, the very observant, or multiple, you know, people who see it multiple times. I don't know. This film feels like almost like a live action cartoon to me, like with the style, the look, the feel of it, and also a lot of the action that happens, like especially when they have that homemade cannon that they're going to shoot the one guy out of.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He flies like a Nine mile years. Into there, then just like plops into the ocean. He's like, and all he is like angry. He's not hurt at all.
Right.
We had the world record, man.
So I don't know. I guess I refer to Jean-Pierre Jeunet as the French Terry Gilliam because of his emphasis on visual aesthetic. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say he's as creative or imaginative or goes as far as Gilliam tends to go, but I could see them. I don't know. I could see them being related.
I could see that. I kind of think of him in a way like kind of like Spike Jones in some ways, or I don't know. But like the visuals are, and like the different ways that he gets his effects are a big part of this filmmaking.
For me, it's kind of like a Terry Gilliam meets Michel Gondry.
Yes. Yeah.
Is how I feel about him.
So if the two of them had a baby, it'd be Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
Yeah, exactly. You've got Gilliam's playfulness, but then I don't know. God, Gondry's kind of weird. I don't know how to describe it. I don't know.
Like quirkiness. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of quirk to it. I think the Jeunet likes to focus on people more than I say Michel Gondry does. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess Gondry does too, but it just seems like people stories. Like, this is the way this character is, and I really want you to know this character. I'm thinking a lot of like Amelie and A Very Long Engagement is a lot like that, too.
Yeah, I'd say with Jeunet more than Gilliam or Gondry, his characters are just as quirky as the films. of the look and the feel of the films.
You know? Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and he shoots his movies for his characters and the way it works. I don't know. He has some great lengthening shots that make people look really tall or short, towering. He kind of tells the story through the cinematography.
Yeah, and I want to go back to a point that I think I can't remember who made it, but that how this is a group effort. It's not just one person going after revenge for a personal issue. Mm-hmm. It becomes more of a collaborative effort, and also the revenge becomes globalized. And I think makes the revenge even more justified than the personal issue, because the whole time you're kind of rooting for him. It's like, yeah, he should do something to these guys.
Yeah.
You know, who are committing, you know, indirect violence on the world. And then when we find out that there's going to be a global message there, it's like, okay, yeah, they definitely deserve what they're getting.
Yeah, and it took away exactly what they valued most, which was something I liked. For the main character, his family all either died or went mad, and then he personally lost his job and everything. But for the character of the two corporations, the heads of the two corporations, they placed more value on their corporation and on their money and things like that. You see that especially with the head boss that has a son and just doesn't hang out with his son and clearly doesn't really like his son very much. So it wasn't like their family that they got revenge on. It was bringing down the names of their corporations and legal consequences for the things that they had done through their corporation. And I liked that.
Yeah, pretty much, you know, destroying their reputations and their lives. And, you know, this is a revenge story where the people who get revenge taken upon them aren't killed or aren't even necessarily harmed physically. So it's almost like a pacifistic revenge story where it's like, let's just, you know, see how we can destroy these people without actually doing any harm, which I think is very in line with the overall message. When it goes that global message of look at all these, you know, people that you're hurting with your arms, and then to, you know, not kill them, I think is very congruent.
Right, because they were getting revenge for physical harm and death. So to cause physical harm or death to the characters would be too ironic, congruent with the original offense that they wanted to get revenge for.
It'd be a little hypocritical.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. So I don't know. I think we should probably move on now.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm not exactly even sure how to pronounce this movie. Is it just Revanche?
Hmm. Yeah, Revanche.
I think it was German for revenge and second chance.
Right.
Yeah, it's actually
yeah.
Austrian, I think.
It's
German and Austria. Or I guess they also have that weird dialect that Alex and the dad are using.
An Austrian film about... Oh, man, now I can't remember the character's name, but about
Alex.
A man.
Alex is the main character. Yeah.
He works... He's gotten out of jail. He's been in jail. He's like an ex-con, so he's working kind of for a brothel, prostitution house kind of place. But he falls in love with one of the prostitutes there, and then he wants to find some money to invest in bar so that he can get away from there and get into a different business, something more profitable for him. And also the woman he's in love with has a lot of debt. So he decides to rob a bank, and this also runs into the issue of coincidence here. As he's coming back from the bank, by coincidence, a police officer who lives out in the country has noticed that the getaway car that his girlfriend is in is parked illegally, and they end up pulling guns on each other, and the police officer accidentally kills the girlfriend as Alex tries to escape the scene of the crime and head out coincidentally to the exact area where that police officer lives. And the rest of the movie in setting is very contrasted against like the first act of the movie, which is something I really like. This movie spends a lot of time on your setting and on, you know, the what the places look like. And the first part of the movie is kind of gross and dingy, and it's all city. And then through the latter parts of the movie, where Alex stays with his sick grandfather, it's very beautiful. And there's like a really nice lake, and it's out in the forest, and he's working on chopping wood and things, and the rest of the movie is just beautiful. And this is a beautifully shot movie, very clear. And I think that they're trying to say something with the contrast of settings, as well as the contrast of the several lives that you encounter and watch throughout this movie. So I don't know. I just think it's a really interesting movie about trying to get revenge, even though the incident was very coincidental. Again,
yeah, I think clear is a good way to describe this movie from my point of view. I think it paints a very, I mean, what it feels to me really realistic. All the characters actually feel like they're in real lives that, you know, may actually happen. It doesn't seem far fetched. I think it's pretty truthful to real characters.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It all seems very factual. All things that could happen, and there are no real twists in this movie, I wouldn't say, except for the girlfriend getting shot, and that really wasn't that much of a twist. But just everything that happens is slow and methodical, and just seems really, you know, like natural consequences for actions, and the idea of consequences for actions and for your lifestyle and your different motives is a big part of it. So I think that conceptually is in line with the themes, like the way that the film moves kind of matches what it's trying to convey.
Yeah, I'd say the entirety of the film and almost every single aspect is very subtle. Like, I think all the characters are subtle. They're played subtly. All the camera work is very subtle. I was actually watching pretty closely. I've seen it a couple of times now. The camera doesn't move that often, and when it does, it's very deliberate and very subtle. And it's almost like in most of the shots, the camera doesn't move, or if it's following a character, it's staying at a fairly consistent distance from the character. But there's not a lot of close-ups in this film.
Yeah, I think that's true.
No, yeah, I think you're correct.
I hadn't thought
about
it.
I think the kind of deliberate nature of all of that goes, I don't know, this film kind of baffles me in some regard. Like, I think it's trying to say things that aren't necessarily getting through. Like, I think there's a lot of, like, interesting imagery that, like, there's that one shot where it's following the car through the woods, and then the car takes a turn, and the camera just keeps on the road and gets on this kind of the shot of this wooden cross put up at the edge of the forest. Like, it's trying to say there's like some kind of like a supernatural attribute to this whole story. Like, I don't know exactly what that was, you know, intended to mean, or if there's even anything really to read in on that. Like, I really didn't see any Christian overtones. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I don't think there's anything
for
really
me.
Christian
I actually had thought about that. And I think that, I thought that the cross there was kind of like a marker of where a car crash had happened and someone had died. So it felt to me like you said, subtlety is the way that is it Spielman? First film, the director. It seems like that's the way he wants to get across his themes and his messages. But like the idea of accidental death, it's just kind of a reminder, like this happens and can happen to people and is a part of life. And I actually did try to find another interpretation of why that was there, but mostly all I could think of was that, you know, death is a part of life and cycles and ending and pain, I guess, is present in this film.
Yeah, I think if he was going to take on the religious overtones, he does it through dad. Because they actually talk about God and you know, his scene with his dad. But I didn't get anything from the imagery. I think he kind of just shows a lot of where they're at sometimes. I felt like he was just kind of showing us where we were.
Okay. Yeah, I figured there had to be a reason for the camera to focus on that specific image. But I think Clayton's interpretation of that is probably the one I think would be more likely. I hadn't actually thought about that. It might just be a representation of how, you know, death is all around us, but, you know, why is it so weird for us to acknowledge it? Why is that so difficult?
Yeah, and it seemed like that was a theme that comes up later with the Alex's old dying grandfather. He doesn't want to leave his farm, even though he needs help and he can't do everything there. He doesn't want to get put in a home or put in a hospital permanently. He's really afraid of having to end his life in a place less ideal and less familiar to him than his home. And I think it's kind of revisiting that idea of, like, and he even says, you know, I'm gonna die anyway, so they can pull me out of here, you know, they can carry me out of this farm because this is where I belong. And kind of just the consequences of life leading to, you know, the end of life is kind of what I see there. But it does also confront the idea of God in relation to people's choices. When the wife of this gets complicated, but when the wife of the police officer sleeps with Alex because they've coincidentally met, and he knows who she is and that she's the wife of the police officer, but she doesn't know who he is really. When they have an affair, he says, "What would your God think of this?" And she just says, "He would understand." And so this idea that if there's a creator, if there's a God, he understands weakness and he understands the presence of all of these things that cause pain. I'm not sure if it even really settles and says anything whether or not that's so, but it's just one of the themes definitely that's present.
Yeah, I mean, we'll probably do a better explanation of all the characters' relation to each other. And I guess, I don't know, it's kind of interesting that Alex, the ex-con, the bank robber, would be the main character, but the opening scene is of the policeman and his wife in their cottage out, you know, in the woods, who are neighbors with Alex's father. And I think that kind of represents that, how, you know, you're shown this and you're not really, you know, clear who's the main character at first, I guess, kind of to show that, you know, this isn't all about just this one character. There's a lot of relationships to consider. So, yeah, the cop, you know, ends up killing Alex's girlfriend, and then he was originally planning on going back to his father's place to hide out anyway, goes there, runs into the wife of the cop because she's there to pick up Alex's father for church, and that's when he finds out that the cop that shot his girlfriend lives just, you know, down the road a piece. And that's where the whole revenge plot goes into play. And essentially, a majority of the film is watching Alex trying to figure out what he's going to do. You know, is he going to kill this cop? But it seems like he spends a lot of time trying to figure out if the cop even feels remorse. And there's that pivotal scene where, you know, he's kind of been stalking the cop on his running route out by the pond. And they end up, you know, striking up a conversation about the whole thing. But Alex is like, "So aren't you the cop that, you know, shot that one girl or something?" And the cop's like, "Yeah, yeah." And kind of spills his guts, saying how, you know, he lives in torment over the whole thing. And then Alex throws his gun into the pond and kind of mirrors that very first image of like a rock going into the water, that upside down water image. That's the very first shot. It's like, that's the moment where it's like, okay, now, you know, we understand more about Alex's true character, you know.
He's soft and wants to be hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This is a bit embarrassing, but I didn't recognize that it was his gun that he had thrown into the water. So that's a very important connection that I didn't even have in my making my decision about this movie.
You mean the scene where he actually throws it in, or are you talking about the very first shot?
No, the scene where he throws it in. I didn't know what he threw in the lake.
Oh, you must have been watching this on a small screen or something.
Watch everything in Blu-ray.
Everyone should watch everything in Blu-ray. No, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree.
I wonder why I missed that. But
then he still, in a regard, gets revenge. Because the whole plot with Alex and the cop's wife, the cop and his wife have been trying to get pregnant. And I think the wife's motivation for sleeping with Alex is to impregnate herself, because it's the cop's fault that he's, you know, got like a, you know, he's shooting blanks or whatever. And so the wife gets pregnant, you know, and says to the, you know, the husband, the cop, I think, you know, this time it worked, we're going to have a kid. And then she goes to tell the good news to Hauser, Alex's father, but come to find out he's, you know, he's passed, and Alex is hanging out with a picture of his girlfriend, the prostitute. And the wife, the pregnant wife, sees that and finally puts the pieces together in her own mind. And her reaction, I think, is one of the strongest moments of the film, where you see just everything in her head just start to fall into place. And she's calculating, like, oh, shit, I've just got myself into this horrendous situation. I'm having the child of the man who's you know, partner, my husband killed. But I'm going to probably still go through with it and just keep quiet about it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. It's a strong moment, and it's crazy. And I couldn't believe that it kind of ended where it did briefly after that without any sort of further revenge or anything. But I think that makes sense with a concept that I think Alex ended up seeing as a parallel between himself and the police officer Robert, is the lack of being able to control the things that happen around you, and that makes Robert sick. His lack of ability to impregnate his wife, and every, like, some of his friends are having babies, and just, he doesn't have control, and he's accidentally killed a woman. He doesn't have control of the things around him. It's this, like, fate element that's a part of the movie, or God element, one or the other, something like that, that really frustrates him. And I think Alex kind of sees the parallel between himself and Robert in that relationship that they have. And so the fact that Robert's wife is going to have his child is enough revenge for him and concludes the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like that idea that, you know, life, you know, exacts revenge on everybody eventually. You know, everyone gets what's coming to them in some regard. And so, yeah, it's an interesting twist on a revenge film in that, yeah, again, no one, you know, except Alex's girlfriend dies. No one is physically harmed, but the emotional damage that is going to happen is huge. But at the same time, that's why I think the title is brilliant, because it means revenge, but also second chances, is now Alex's seed is going to be raised by the cop. You know, so it's almost like he's forcing retribution. He's forcing kind of, you know, this situation where he has to make, you know, restitution in some degree. I don't know. I love this film. I've seen it a couple of times now. I actually own a copy. Another thing. I don't know if you guys noticed, but the first time I watched it, I didn't notice until the credits started rolling. There's no music. There's no soundtrack, except for music that's played. Played naturally through like a radio or how they're playing his accordion. Other than that, no artificial music.
I don't know why I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant, because it, I think it elevates the realistic nature of the film.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's just so much a movie about this story. It just wants to convey a story that could really happen. And it wants
the simplest way possible.
Let all of the characters work the way that they would without any added effect for emotion. But in doing that, it has just as much emotion, if not more, than most other movies I've seen. It's so Shakespearean, and just about the way all these characters relate to each other and to this circumstance.
This is a written, directed by the same person movie, right? He wrote and directed it. Damn.
I guess this is his fifth full-length film, from what I understand, but it's his first one to actually come to the United States, and it was a contender for Best Foreign Film. What was it, 2008? Yeah.
Not shocked. It's really good. There's no way around it.
All right, so unless you guys have anything else to say, we should probably move on, keep it going.
Off we go.
Off we go. All right. I guess that means work
to
me.
Last but not least.
Last but not least, of course, because I cheated and went with Sergio Leone. I chose Once Upon a Time in the West. Sergio Leone, he's made every Western movie that mattered, I guess. he did the Man with No Name series, and everyone's seen those. Essentially what you've got here, it's going to be really hard to give a summary of this because every character, it seems, every interaction is actually building the story and telling more of it. So it's hard to paraphrase without any of the information. But what you basically got is a slab of land that an innocent man is trying to hold out on and have a train stop go through. But you've got a greedy sort of railroad baron that's trying to take over the land. That is the best I can kind of put the setup. you've got Henry Fonda in this. You've got Charles Bronson. I don't even know where to really start. The first 15 minutes of this movie, probably one of my favorite openings ever. It's
good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost completely silent. You've got a train station and you've got a bunch of people that are obviously there and they're kind of just waiting for something. And we don't get any dialogue and we basically just get a bunch of people looking at each other. And it's the best, you know, no sound I've ever seen. Yeah, I was reading, this is totally a tangent that's related to it, Breaking Bad, the Vince Gilligan. He actually cites the first 15 minutes of this movie as his inspiration for Breaking Bad. And I'm not shocked by it because it reminds me quite a bit of the way Breaking Bad's shot. Total tangent. Let's go back.
Well, I'm not surprised by that. Yeah, that opening is just brilliant, especially with the one guy when he sits down and he's messing with that fly. I don't know how they were able to capture that. Like, that must have taken so long, because you can't get a fly to cooperate.
Yeah,
right.
And there's no digital, you know, animation back in, what is it, 1969, 68?
Mm-hmm. I think that they were just shooting, I don't know, and that must have just been coincidence.
It was improvised, yeah.
But it's really, I think, really good at illustrating, like, the patience of these people and building so much tension. It's just like, what is the motive of these kind of looters? Like, what are they doing here at this train station? And it takes so long to get to where you're going that it's really, I don't know. It's just one of the best experiences to watch that 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Charlie Bronson shows up on a train passes, and then when it leaves the station, on the other side there's good old Charles Bronson.
Right.
And the thing I think that's most brilliant about this film, and I think Ryan, you kind of hit on it. It's kind of difficult to really summarize the plot. I mean, it's also difficult to say, you know, who's going for revenge on who, because it's not clear, you know, starting out. Like, we seriously, for about the first hour of the film, don't really understand what people's connections are to each other. It's all just exposition and character development. And then finally, the pieces start to unfold slowly, and we start to see, you know, who's going after who and why. And then it's like, you know, we don't know, like, what the revenge is for or why until about, I don't know, how long is this movie? Almost 3 hours? It's like 2 hours, 45 minutes? It's about 2.5 hours in, we're finally like, okay, now we understand, you know, what this is all
about. This is a revenge movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't even really know it's a revenge movie until the end.
Until the end.
Yeah. And then
you guys said the same thing.
Yeah, you finally piece it together at the end. You finally get all the clues, and you finally understand all of these characters, and you finally realize, you know, what the motives for all these people are, what their end game is. But it's very slow building, giving us, you know, little bits of information and letting us figure it out. It's very character-based, and that's why I brought up Breaking Bad, because it's the exact same thing.
Oh, yeah. And nothing is spelled out for the audience. It's all like, you just got to sit and enjoy the ride, and it'll all become clear, which is why I don't think this movie would work today. I don't think the general film-going audience has the attention span for this kind of movie anymore, which is a shame, I think, because I think this is brilliant. This is the only other Leone film I've seen besides the Man with No Name trilogy, and I think it kind of almost just blows those three out of the water.
It's the best one by far. I mean,
yeah.
I think. I mean, it's all a matter of opinion. Mm-hmm. It's brilliant.
For me, it's because of how nothing's spelled out. I mean, it's kind of along the same line of, you know, Clint Eastwood's character in the Man with No Name trilogy. You never understand. You never get his backstory. Never understand his motives. But in this one, it's like you understand the motives, but it's like you have to sit through 2.5 hours of, you know, awesome movie to figure it out.
Yeah, and it's a lot of reactionary. It's a lot of characters, and you're put in environments with lots of characters that you don't really know anything about at first, and you just sort of watch them go about and slowly learn from them. And then it just keeps following a few characters a little bit more than others, and you sort of kind of realize who this movie's completely about.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about it. It's like, this is nearly a three-hour-long movie, but I can't imagine the screenplay was more than 80 pages. There's not a lot of dialogue. Mm-mm. But that's the brilliance of Leone, is he is the master of the close-up.
Tells like, he's got a lot of
faces and close-ups. And I think, I don't know, I didn't really start counting, but I think Charles Bronson, even though this, he's like a lead, he's a lead actor here, I bet he's only got maybe 30 lines.
Yeah, he doesn't say a lot.
It's acted superbly. It's all in the face.
Oh, we lost someone.
That's Clayton.
Clayton. Yep, it's all in the face. Clayton.
All in the face.
And another thing that they do with this movie is you don't really see Henry Fonda as the bad guy. I mean,
no, I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's a total, like, he's always the nice guy, because you just, I mean, his eyes are just kind, but in this movie he kind of does a complete role reversal, and you kind of buy into him just being a little bit ahead of everybody else's game, and that's why he's on top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he definitely, you believe when you see him that he'll do what's necessary, but he still kind of comes off as a little bit of a gentleman.
Yeah. Oh, wow, I'm reading on the IMDb. This actually takes place in Utah.
Yeah, it says Utah in the very opening scene.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it drops Utah in there. It says it's in Utah. And I don't remember the year. Yeah, so you basically got the railroad that's being built. I guess we can do a little bit of backstory. The railroad that's being built, and you have a piece of land in Sweetwater called Sweetwater. It's this ranch that no one would ever want to do anything with. It's this dirty scrap of land. But it's exactly in between two railroad points that need to meet. And so you've got greedy railroad tycoon that's just trying to take over the land in any way possible, and so you get it's kind of hard to explain the family, the opening family, the McBain family, I believe they are.
Mm-hmm.
It basically starts out with some hired guns, basically just kind of wipe out this family for the land, and you've got what's her complete relation? Is it a sister or a cousin that's coming to visit from New Orleans?
Wife.
Jesus, that was his wife.
Well, it's like when she finally shows up and finds everyone dead, like the party they were going to have was for their wedding. They were actually going to get married, but then she drops the bomb as soon as she gets there, sees everyone's been murdered. It's like, we secretly got married in New Orleans a week ago. And I was coming in to, you know.
I don't know how I missed that. For some reason, I thought it was like a sister or something. Hey, it doesn't matter because they're all dead and she's there by herself.
Yeah.
She just didn't seem to I didn't really believe it because she was from New Orleans and they obviously looked up a family that had been living out there for some time, and she didn't seem like she knew the environment that well.
Yeah. Well, because he'd been living in New Orleans.
I guess that's right. McBain. They just got married.
McBain, okay. I've been courting her out in New Orleans, yeah.
I see. Damn details.
yeah.
Problem is, I was just watching. I was looking at this movie. I want to look at it. It's sometimes that's what my focus goes on, you know. And it's so, the score in this movie is perfect. Every lead, I think, has their own basically theme song, and if you focus, you'll notice it because he does so many close-ups and he does so many long shots. It's very long shots that's what Leone does.
Yeah.
And you can actually, if you focus on it, you'll start to learn who the scene's going to go around based off of the music.
Oh, yeah. Ennio Morricone. That's something I forgot to bring up on our Monsters episode, is he actually did the score for Carpenter's The Thing.
Not surprised.
Yeah, but it's fascinating to see, like, when an actual talented filmmaker uses the tricks of filmmaking to increase tension or to, you know, divert your attention one way, or, you know, I thought there's one part where it got a little gimmicky during the auction, where it's like at the last possible second, down comes, you know, Charlie Bronson saying, "I'll give you $5,000 or whatever." You see that coming a mile away. Not that it was bad. I liked it. I was like, you know, of course this movie's going to have a scene like that.
That just might be the character a little bit more. I think I've kind of felt like is kind of like a melting pot of a bunch of different Westerns.
Yeah, it seems like, Harmonica, Charlie Bronson's character, it seems like he only acts at the last moment he needs to.
Mm-hmm. And so when he lets it come down to the wire, then he does what has to be done. But this movie's slower paced for most of it. And I don't fault him for making a slow movie.
Oh, no, not at all.
I think it's required for the way that he's telling the story.
I agree. And it lets the film breathe. Like I said, you know, all these long, you know, takes on close shots and building the tension that way. You take that away and you start shortening the cuts, it's going to destroy that tension. It's going to, you know, make it a completely different movie.
Yeah. I feel like
I appreciate the only thing.
He drags stuff out too, and he kind of just makes us feel comfortable where we're at. And then he'll change it around on us and sort of just take us out of what we've just, you know, become embraced in and put us in a new environment. I don't know. It's kind of weird to describe it like that. That's, I don't know. This movie's just amazing.
Yeah. So apparently Clayton's off the show.
Yeah. Do you know what year this is supposed to be? I know it's supposed to be in Utah, and I'm imagining this is just after the Civil War.
Yeah, I'd imagine, probably anywhere between like 1870 and 1900. I don't know. I don't think it's ever specifically clear, but I bet, you know, you get a historian on it.
Yeah, you can probably nail it down. Yeah, and I don't think we saw very many Bronson movies like this at all. I think this is quite a bit significantly different than most of his other work.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to see him. Or when I saw his name in the credit, I was like, I didn't know he was in this. It's awesome. But I think it's, you know, kind of a testament to letting film, you know, people, creative filmmakers, you know, let them do what they're going to do, and the studio shouldn't intervene. I mean, you look at the writing credits for this, it's story by Sergio Leone, Dario Argento, and Bernardo Bertolucci, who's another big Italian director. It's like these three powerhouses of film getting together, and this is what you get. It's like, I don't understand studio intervention. It's like it seems the people who are the least adept at identifying quality in film are the ones in charge of producing it.
Yeah, there are people that are producing movies are usually concerned about money more than the story.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems like every single time a good filmmaker, someone who's super talented, super creative, they're allowed to do what they want to do. The film is incredibly good, and usually if it's, you know, if the studio puts, you know, faith in it and markets it correctly, it does well. It's like, I don't know why they don't look at that.
I always wondered why you would find out about these movies that have like 7 minutes cut out of it.
Yeah, it's like, it's
from a studio. I can't believe that kind of stuff. It's 7 minutes.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. I guess if a producer sits down, watches it, and says, you know, there's parts where I felt kind of bored, trim it up. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I went and after we watched 13 Assassins, I decided I wanted to see more Miike, and I sought out the Sukiyaki Western to Django.
Yeah.
The one available for streaming on Netflix or the disc is, I think, more than 20 minutes shorter than the original Japanese version.
Ugh.
So I downloaded the original Japanese version, and I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It's like, I can't imagine what you take out of this. You could probably eliminate a whole character. Mm-hmm. That was about 20 minutes, and then, I don't know. But I had to watch it with subtitles, even though it's in English.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mind watching movies with subtitles. Like you said before, I think I've just done it so much that I'm trained to do it. I think that I do see a lot, but I mean, you're doing a lot when you watch a movie with subtitles. You're reading, you're comprehending, right? You're watching, mm-hmm. you're listening. And then, you know, aside from that, you're plotting. You're trying to put all the pieces together in a decent movie. So it can be a bit much.
Yeah.
If you could pick one language that you could learn to watch movies easier, based solely on just because of movies that you prefer, what language would you choose to speak fluently?
Japanese.
Japanese? Me too.
Japanese, straight up.
Yeah,
question.
I can get enough of French if I need to.
Yeah, I've noticed, I've picked up some French just by watching the films, probably because it's, you know, more related than Japanese. But
yeah Spanish isn't rough.
But I'd probably say, I don't know, a close second might be French, maybe German. I don't see a lot of German films, but I love the language.
Some of my favorite movies are German.
Oh, yeah? Which one?
Yeah. Have you ever seen The Lives of Others?
I have not.
It's about Stasi.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, no, I know about it. I actually owned a DVD copy for a while. I picked up used at like a Blockbuster. But I never got around to it for some reason. And when I upgraded to Blu-ray, I just, like, I haven't watched this. And I think it was available for streaming. So I was like, I'm just going to get rid of this. But I always wanted to see it because that beat Pan's Labyrinth for best foreign film. I think Pan's Labyrinth is just hits.
Yeah. You should see The Lives of Others.
Okay, I will. Maybe we'll have to do a category showing on that one.
It's not shabby, that's for sure. Well, hell, is Clayton not coming back on or what?
Yeah, I haven't heard anything from him.
Maybe his phone died.
Possibly.
I'm going to guess.
He's scrambling.
Well, hell, Clayton. That's a bummer, man. So, did you finally finish fucking Breaking Bad?
No, I haven't made any. Whoa.
Damn it. Whoa.
Hey, guys.
Oh, hi there.
Yeah. Apparently, I don't pay my cell phone bill often enough. Yeah. So, did you guys finish getting through Once Upon a Time in the West?
I think so. I don't know. We probably talked another 5 to 10 minutes about the movie. So I think we handled it, unless there's anything you wanted to add specifically.
I think just my biggest thing with that movie that we hadn't gotten to when I lost my phone privileges was the music and how it relied on the music to kind of move from scene to scene and also to identify characters really well, especially with the nameless harmonica player. Just that scene, every time I would come in, it was just like, wait, where is he? He's here. He's got to be here. That was really cool. Just like a heightened awareness of the use of music, more than probably any other Westerns that I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was kind of trippy because when the harmonica starts playing, it sounds like it's in the score. You know, it was recorded in post.
Yeah.
But then, you know, people will turn and react to it, and then you'll see there's Charlie Bronson playing his harmonica. It kind of bothered me at first that you could tell he wasn't really playing it, but I don't know. I loved watching this movie so much that I just rolled with it.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. When you know how to play an instrument, you can tell someone's not actually playing it. That did bother me, but I guess really the only way they could have gotten away or around that would be to teach him the harmonica line so that he had to play it when, and then they could like put the score over it anyway afterward. But
I mean, because they would have done it in post anyway, because Italian films, even up until like the mid to late 70s, they did all of the audio in post, like all of the dialogue,
wow,
all of the music. Nothing was, you know, nothing was recorded while they shot the film. That's just how they did it in Italian films for some reason. Like, you've seen Solo. It's the same in Solo. That was, I think that was a 70s Italian film.
I didn't know that about Solo either. And yes, I have seen Solo and wish I hadn't.
It's a fantastic film.
What don't you like about it, Clayton?
I have a hard time pinning down very many things I do like about that movie.
We got to discuss that one. I think I could go on a diatribe about its merits.
Yeah, I could probably defend it on a couple points, really. But
No, it's a movie that you don't want to see all the time, on purpose.
You don't want to defend it.
You know, funny, when I bought a copy of that, I was actually at the Gray Whale up by the University of Utah. And I just pulled it off the shelf. You know, I was buying with another couple of things, and the guy at the counter was like, you know, I actually sat through that once, and never again.
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
Well,
so rental.
if you guys don't mind, I might hop off so I can get myself down to the T-Mobile store and pay my cell phone bill.
To get involved in the discussion, you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/3filmegos, follow us on Twitter, @3filmegos, or email us at 3filmegos@gmail.com. You can also comment at 3filmegos.podomatic.com, where you can also donate and subscribe to the show. Music provided by 90s Television. You can hear more of their music on Facebook. On our next episode, Snubbed, or the Best Picture nominees we think should have won. We've been the 3 Filmegos. Thanks for listening.
So, I don't know. Ryan was talking about maybe wanting to see both versions of Apocalypse Now before we talk about it, and I kind of agreed.
Yeah, I think... I can't remember which one I saw, if it was Redux or...
Was it 3 or 2 hours?
Original cut.
Well, no, was it three or four?
I think it was 3 hours.
Let's see, the theatrical cut is a little over 2.5 hours. The Redux as an extra looks like 50 minutes. So it's going to be three and a half hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Holy cow. No, I think I did. No, that's not possible. I don't think I could have watched it for 3.5 hours because it was on one VHS cassette.
Were there, well, that's possible. Were there French people?
VHS.
They spend a long time with a French family?
A French family?
Okay.
No, I don't think so.
You didn't watch the Redux.
VHS.
Right. Dude, I love VHS. Maybe not for that movie, but there are certain movies that I feel like VHS is the format you should be watching that movie in.
No. I watched it on Blu-ray,
yeah.
And it changed my life.
Right. Well, with Apocalypse Now, I definitely agree. Blu-ray would have been better, a lot better.
But I
wouldn't trade...
on VHS. Except John.
No, VHS is great for certain movies, like the warmth and the crackle, and oh man, I love it.
It's not a vinyl record, Clayton.
It is. It is though.
Dude, I don't even have a VCR.
Well,
so.
You and most people, but I'm proud of my VHS collection. I've got like 150 really cool tapes. I've got a colorized tape of It's a Wonderful Life. Like for a while they released like VHS of It's a Wonderful Life in color, and
wow.
It's the worst thing ever.
The Blu-ray of It's a Wonderful Life comes with both the original black and white and the colorized version.
The colorized looks awful, but like as like a funny thing to put in the background.
Yeah, I think it was redigitized for the Blu-ray because it on the Blu-ray it looked good, but it looked really creepy because you know it's not supposed to be in color. Like, it's really alarming.